and it's all absolutely free. So things I don't cover that you have questions about, I encourage you to go there, type your question into the search engine. You can grab some cards with the web address on there as well. So we're going to be talking about this book. It was actually the first book I've written. It's now in its eighth printing. And we talk about it being an Amazon top 50 bestseller, but we don't say that to boast. In fact, we estimate that probably at least, if not more, non-believers, non-Christians have actually read this book than Christians. And so it's one of the reasons I read it. Again, this morning I focused on evangelism. And of course, we want Christianity to be relevant. It is relevant to the culture. Christianity, obviously, is at the core of why we think you and I are here, etc. So let's go through. We're going to talk about some science aspects before we get into, if you like, the juicy bits. Now, some of you, my vintage or a bit older, you would remember this man, Carl Sagan, arguably in his day the world's most famous scientist. In fact, he wrote the world's largest selling science book of all time. And he had a TV show, do you remember that one, called Cosmos? And in the introductions, the wave used to crash on the shore, and he said, "The cosmos is all that is, ever was, or will be." And what he meant by that was atoms are all there ever will be, etc. He's what we call a materialist. Not in acquiring wealth for yourself, but matter is all there is. But for materialists, the origin of life on Earth is still a mystery to them. You might read the textbooks that say, and I mentioned it this morning, you know, 3 billion years ago, chemicals got together to form the first amino acids, the first proteins, etc. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this, because in modern science, particularly in biology and the study of genetics, when we look at the complexity of the cell, okay, you've heard things like the simple cell, or, you know, that a cell is like a factory. It's completely inadequate description. They call it the city of the cell. What does a city have? Well, we have power plants that burn energy, you know, other factories that help produce the energy that the power plants burn. We have transportation mechanisms, highways, etc., communication systems. The cell has all of this. There is nothing simple about a cell. And so when they started to look at the cell, people came up with the idea that it looks designed. But remember I said this morning, it's not about science. In fact, one of the co-discoverers of the DNA molecule, Francis Crick, seated there, deceased now, he and his colleague James Watson were given a Nobel Prize for the discovery of the DNA molecule. But Crick, seated, was an open and declared atheist. In fact, he said one of the reasons he entered the sciences was to disprove the notion of a supernatural creator. But hang on, they were confronted, we estimate, 3 billion letters in the human genome. The genome is the library. Let me put that into context. That's like stacking 1,000 Bibles on top of one another, and every letter in that 1,000 Bibles worth of information has to be in exactly the right spot, the right order to tell the cell what to build, what shade of skin you're going to have, whether you're going to be a frog, a fish, an elephant. The DNA codes for all of that. So I wrote an article back in 2003 to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the discovery of the DNA molecule, and I pointed in there that Crick, when he was confronted with this information, back then he said the aliens must have put it there. He was an evolutionist. He believed that, you know, life proliferated through the galaxy. That's known as something called panspermia. There's two methods. Seeds from space, that's literally what it means, either float here or it's intentional, directed. Aliens visited us and seeded life on Earth. So we're going to talk about that because that's virtually become mainstream science in the biological sciences today. So first we have to understand what evolution prescribes. It says you've got to get from something simple to complex. The simplest living organism, the simplest in the world today, is a bacterium. And it has 580,000 letters of information. That's the simplest organism today. Every letter has to be in the right place. But if you want to get from 500,000 letters to 3 billion letters of human beings, you've got to have a mechanism that adds information. Now, this morning, I threw in the term natural selection a couple of times. So you young people here, if you go in, and you may have heard this already, but particularly if you go to college, you're going to hear your lecturers say this. And if I had a dollar for every time I've heard it, I'd be a rich man. Look, creatures change over time. They'll point to different dogs and different horses, etc. Creatures change over time, therefore evolution is true. Natural selection is a mechanism, they believe, that nature culls the weak, but in the process, it selects species or other creatures that have new genetic information. If you want to turn bacteria into biologists, you've got to add new genetic information, novel genetic information. So this is really important. Parents, grandparents, students, in all my years of ministry, natural selection is the greatest stumbling block to young people believing that evolution is true. But actually, you know, the term natural selection was invented by a creationist, Edward Blyth, the contemporary of Darwin. So let's do this experiment today. By the way, this also deals with, could seeds on Earth from space somehow rearrange themselves into complex living organisms? And I'm going to use the example of dogs, because we're all familiar with dogs. Some of you may even breed dogs. And Darwin himself was a pigeon breeder. So he actually, to be honest, should have known better that there were always going to be limits to the change and the traits that he was selecting. So go along with me here. We've got mum and dad dog, okay? Now those things in their tummy there, this is obviously illustrated, these are genes. A gene is like a set of instructions. The genome is the library. So these dogs, I want you to imagine, have medium length fur, middle length fur. They're in the medium range of fur length. So why? Because dad here, he's got a gene for short fur and a gene for long fur. And mum's got a gene for short fur and a gene for long fur. They've got all the genetic information necessary to produce differing lengths of offspring, different fur lengths in their offspring. So let's have a look. So they get married, walk down the aisle, and they have puppies. So this one here ended up with short fur. Why? Well, you remember from your biology classes at school, we get one set of instructions from each of our parents. So this guy here, he inherited the short fur gene from dad and the short fur gene from mum. So he's different from the parents. These ones here, they're medium length fur like the parents. So we got here short fur gene from dad, long fur gene from mum, vice versa, long fur gene from dad, short fur gene from mum. So a different combination of the genes, but they're still expressed in the medium range like the parents. And then what happened to this critter? Okay. So she only inherited the genes for long fur from each of her parents. So have a look. We've got change in one generation. Okay? So creatures do change, but here's the thing. Has any new information been created? No. To get change, it has to come from information that was already present in the parent population. See that? Nothing new has been created, just the different combinations of what is pre-existing. So let's say we've got a whole group of dogs ranging from short, medium to long fur, and the environment gets really, really cold. You know, we'll throw them in a truckload of these dogs in Alaska or something in a particularly bad winter. Which ones have a survival advantage in a cold environment? Long fur, okay, it's not rocket science. So nature selects. Now, that's just a convenient term, because nature's not some conscious, living, thinking entity, right? But it's just a convenient term to describe what we see in nature, that creatures without a favourable adaptation or trait will get knocked out, okay, in certain environments. So essentially, you could say these ones get selected. So the cold weather knocks out dogs with short fur and medium fur, the ones with long fur survive, and now what happens when they reproduce? They'll only reproduce dogs with long fur. Further change, in fact, they've become specialised to their environment. Still anything new being created? What does evolution require? New information? All right. In fact, there's a problem for evolution, because what natural selection has done here, it's reduced the genetic information from the population. Okay? They can be adapted to their environment, but guess what? We've lost the genes for short and medium fur from the population, and yet we have these adapted perfectly to cold weather. And I use dogs because you're all familiar that the idea with breeders of what they call pure breeds. I'm sorry, actually, pure breeds are just degenerate mutts. But anyway, you know you can not closely interbreed with creatures of or dogs of a similar breed because you get what we call it inbreeding, right? And I actually have a particularly disturbing picture of an inbred dog. Do you want to see it? The consequences? Okay, here's an inbred dog for you. All right. Poor thing. So the Bible doesn't use the term species either. So young ones, this is another trick. Oh, look, but we see new species. Species is a man-made word. Okay? We can use species too. Lions and tigers are described as separate species, but they'll interbreed. In fact, every known member, even on different continents, of the cat family can interbreed. That tells you they came from what the Bible calls a kind. 10 times in Genesis 1, God created according to their kind, his kind, a hat kind, a cat kind, a dog kind, a horse kind. Now, sometimes you can keep selecting down, or even nature can do that, so they'll no longer interbreed with the parent population that they came from. Again, that's a reduction in genetic information. What does evolution require? New information. You've got to add encyclopedia's worth of information to the genes, to the genome. So DNA has been often described as the most complex information storage mechanism in the known universe. Some of you IT people will know they're trying to copy the compression levels of DNA, etc. In fact, one of the most world-renowned famous physicists is an atheist by the name of Professor Paul Davies, but he admitted this. How did stupid atoms spontaneously write their own software? Nobody knows. There is no known laws of physics able to create information from nothing. Bingo. You know, when you look at a Bible, right? Hold your Bible up and you'll see, this is a hymn book, but you get the point. When I see all the letters on the page, are the letters by themselves information? No, letters have to be arranged into words and sentences to produce an information code. Randomness does not produce information. And our DNA is like that, all 3 billion letters of it. And that's why people resort now to ideas that aliens may have created life here on Earth. But that doesn't answer the problem, does it? Because if aliens created humans, who created the aliens that created humans? And then who were the creators of the aliens that created humans? You know how it goes. It's called the infinite regression problem, by the way. Oops, I'm going to go back the other way. So, quite simply, life can occur here on Earth. Okay, there are only two games in town, and it's the same when we look elsewhere in the universe. Either God created, I'm going to deal with that question later, but right at the core of alien, the belief in alien life, reason Crick and scientists believe that aliens could have created life here, is the Big Bang. Big Bang is part of what we call cosmic evolution. The universe had to evolve at some stage. And I'm going to give you kind of the condensed layman's version of the Big Bang, but let's see if we remember anything from this morning. I obviously don't believe there is a Big Bang, but would the Big Bang fall under operational science or historical science? Well done, historical science. Why? Because it occurred one time in the past, has never been seen, you can't repeat it, and so on. It's not kind of real science as you and I would understand it. Now, I'm going to give you the condensed layman's version of the Big Bang, because a lot of Christians say, well, God could have used a Big Bang, etc. Well, it says that the Earth and the moon cooled from a hot molten mass at some stage. The Bible says that the universe came out of water. Read 2 Peter. So here's the condensed version. In the beginning, there was nothing. Now, when I say nothing, I'm not even talking about empty space. Space is an entity. Einstein called it the ether. It's a medium through which light is transmitted. Space can be bent and warped. We can see that. Gravity does that to light. So there's nothing. There's no universe. There's no space. There's not even a single atom. And in this nothingness, something pops into existence called a quantum particle. It's a little particle of energy, say no bigger than the head of a pin, And then for some reason, this pinhead's worth of energy expands, it explodes, derisively called the Big Bang. And then over millions and billions of years, energy converts to matter, E equals mc squared. And ultimately, you know, planets, stars, galaxy forms, and then human beings and other creatures come along. So therefore, the belief is, in a Big Bang universe 14 billion years ago, that life must have evolved countless times over elsewhere. As I said this morning, maybe those aliens have evolved millions of years in advance of us, and that's how come they are millions of years advanced in their technology and can build hyperdrive spaceships, visit the Earth, etc. And in case you think I'm being disingenuous or discrediting or mocking it, I never do that because I'm a former revolutionist myself, Professor Alan Guth is the father of the inflation theory of the Big Bang, and in a science magazine, his work was summarized thus. It says, the universe burst into something from nothing, absolutely zero, nada. And as it got bigger, it became filled with even more stuff that came from absolutely nowhere. There you go. They said it. I love this, though. It says, let me get this straight. First, there was nothing, and then it exploded. So the reason I mention that is, yes, it's at the core of the belief of alien life, but often you will hear skeptics, the atheists, say, well, you Christians, you just always resort to God did it. He did a miracle or something. But actually, the evolutionists do that themselves. This violates a law known as the law of causality, which says everything which has a beginning in time in our physical space-time universe must have had a cause. Look around. You can look at anything, the tree outside, a rock on the ground. It had a beginning in time, therefore it must have had a cause. But they have something popping into existence with no cause. See? So evolution's full of its supernatural. Natural selection. They believe countless times over that mutations plus natural selection must have created new information, right? To turn dinosaurs into birds. What we observe in nature, what I just showed you there, we've never seen a single observable example of that. Another supernatural event that evolutionists have to refer to. And for me, one of the most profound passages in the Bible is the very first one. I mean, it's not there by chance. Before everything that follows, God is setting up that He is the Creator. And interestingly, there's a bit of information there. It's a loaded statement because it says, in the beginning, God. That's saying He must have been there first before He created the heavens and earth. And one of the most asked questions teens often ask me, and the skeptics like to point out, well, if God's the Creator, who made God? Okay. Do you remember I said everything which has a beginning has a cause? That's because when the universe was created, right? This morning I talked about the 6 days. There's the earth, there's a light source. God defines a day in our little section of the solar system. But if you lived on Venus, I think a Venusian day is 217 earth days. So we measure time relative to what we use to measure it with. Okay? But here's the point. When God created the universe, time, as you and I understand it, began. Before the universe, did time exist? No. It's very hard for us to even conceive, isn't it? Timelessness. But hang on, that's where God is. God is not bound by time. He is the great I am. I am that I am. I just am. People often say, well, you know, if God created in 6 days, what was He doing billions of years before He created? It's a non-question. That is who God is. So when we think about, you know, time, who created God, we're thinking from our own three-dimensional sphere here on the earth. Right? If time didn't exist, God does not have a beginning. Therefore, He doesn't need a cause. He's the self-existent one, etc. Okay. Head spinning now. All right, so let's get into the UFO stuff. I'm obviously a sci-fi fan and a bit of a space junkie, if I can put it that way. I've visited all the major places in the US Huntsville, the Jet Propulsion Laboratories, and the Kennedy Space Center. And growing up, I just loved the Apollo missions. And the Apollo missions were due to go into the 20s. Apollo 17 was the last one. It became expensive. People couldn't see us devoting, you know, whatever it was, 10% of our budget to it. And so they cancelled it. But this man took over, the former chief administrator, Dan Golden. And he reinvented NASA. And he started something called the Origins Program. Think about that word, origins, okay? Belief in evolution. And the rovers we have on Mars right now, or only one of them still working, is part of the Origins Program. The new Hubble Space Telescope, James Webb Telescope are part of it. And what they're doing, as you can say here, he listed that one of their goals was to search for Earth-like planets that may be habitable or inhabited. So there's a pre-belief that life must exist out there. Why? Because of the Big Bang. They think the further they look out, that they're looking back in time. Kind of sounds like they're looking for Obi-Wan Kenobi sitting in a cave in Tatooine somewhere, but that's not the type of life they're looking for. Microbes on Mars. They're excited about finding water on Mars. Hey, where there's water, there might be life. But you all know water's a fairly simple compound, isn't it? H2O, compared to 3 billion letters required to, you know, get to human beings. So the stuff that mainly impresses us in science fiction and kind of captures the imagination of the masses with statements like this is something in UFO circles known as the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And this is the idea that real physical aliens are flying in physical spaceships, visiting the Earth, flying around the galaxy or the universe, etc. And you can see I've written there that it became popular in the 50s and 60s. People my age remember all those B-grade science fiction movies we used to watch. But as our understanding about the size of the universe increased, it became obvious that aliens could not travel thousands, hundreds of thousands, or billions of light years to get here. It would require multiple generations, right? I mean, you'd have to raise your children to be nuclear physicists to run the engines on the ship, and then they'd have to raise their children to be nuclear physicists and so on. We don't think that far in advance. Unless, of course, you've got one of these babies. So here we are. Watch this, Pastor. All the Trekkies, come out the closet. Where are you? See, there they are. They're in every church. All right. Live long and prosper. So these guys fly at warp speed. Warp speed is multiple factors of light speed. Let's have a look at how realistic these science fiction concepts are. As I said, I've visited the Kennedy Space Center, etc. You know, the Saturn V rockets that took men to the moon and the former space shuttle here, they are the most powerful vehicles that mankind ever built. We're just on the dawn of new rockets that are actually even more powerful than these. And when they go up, and if they're successful, I'll change it. But to date, these are the ones that work and are still the most powerful that we have. Do you know the two solid, just the main engines here, so these guys, these are called SRBs, solid rocket boosters. But just the three main engines here, firing those for just 2 minutes could supply, if you could convert it to electrical energy, could supply the power for 87,000 homes for a full day. Just firing those for 2 minutes. And that's the most powerful vehicle we've ever built. But, you know, here's the problem, Independence Day. At the best speed of Apollo, it would take you 870,000 years to reach the next star to our own sun in our own Milky Way galaxy. That's the fastest we've been able to produce. Now, let me put that into context. Our sun is a star. We're in the Milky Way, a galaxy. We think there might be 200 billion stars in our Milky Way. So the next one is Proxima Centauri. Would take us 870,000 years to reach. By the way, the next galaxy to our own Milky Way, Andromeda, is 2 million light years away. What's a light year? It's not a measurement of time. Okay, it's a measure, sorry, not a measurement of time, it's a measurement of distance. If you could travel at the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, it would take you 2 million years to reach the next galaxy to our own. And the next galaxy after that is 20 million light years away. And you haven't even begun to travel the universe, because there are hundreds of billions of galaxies, all containing hundreds of billions of stars. Keep that in mind as we go along. So let's have a look at it. I want you to imagine if I had something about the size of a softball, right? About just over a pound in weight. To accelerate that to half the speed of light, represented by the letter C, it would take the energy equivalent of 98 Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs. That's just to accelerate it to half the speed of light. But every journey, return trip, you've got to use 4 times the energy, because I've got to use the same energy requirements. Once I'm in the vacuum of space, I'll just keep going at that speed. So to slow down, I have to use the same energy requirements to bring myself to slow down. And then the return trip, I've got to speed up, and then when I get to the Earth, I've got to slow down again. A fourfold input of that energy. Space is not empty, by the way. It's full of stuff. Cosmic dust. And it's estimated there's about 100,000 particles of cosmic dust for every cubic kilometer of space. And impacting one grain of dust at 1/10 of the speed of light, that would be like 10 tons of TNT impacting on the hull of your spacecraft. Now, the Star Trek fans know they have these things on the Enterprise called deflector arrays. Remember that? So they're kind of like force fields. But guess what? That just adds to the energy requirements, because you've got to use the equally or the similar amount of opposing force to be able to repel that grain of dust. By the way, here's a couple of panels on the Hubble Space Telescope. Now, that guy, he just sits there in what we call geosynchronous orbit. So it's just matching the rotation of the Earth, not going anywhere near fast enough you need to, you know, to travel to distant planets or star systems. Now, just grains of dust, but look how much there are. Don't do serious damage, because it's not going that fast. In 1983, the former Space Shuttle Challenger impacted a flake of paint, probably from another satellite or something in space, 0.2 of a millimeter in size. Right? How big a millimeter is? So a fraction of a millimeter in size, and that's the damage it caused to the window. The window had to be replaced. Back then, at a cost of $50,000, you could probably multiply that by about 10 now. Other problems, G-forces. We measure gravity by Earth, so as we stand here now, you know, we're being exerted to 1G, Earth's gravity. Some of you, if you've ever been to the theme parks and you do the giant drops or really, really fast roller coasters, you know, you might pull 2-3 Gs. Air Force pilots, fighter pilots, they undergo training, they can pull 9 Gs. But if they do that for more than a little while, for a few seconds, you will black out, okay? So when you watch Star Trek and Captain Jean-Luc Picard sits on board of the Enterprise and his plumpy English accent says, "Make it so," you'd be exerting millions of Gs upon the occupants. But again, science fiction to the rescue. Does any science fiction fan, Star Trek fan, know what they have on board the Enterprise? To avoid them getting splattered up against the wall when they do U-turns at warp factor 6? No? Shame on you. Okay, they're called inertial dampeners. All right. For the rest of you who don't watch Star Trek, sorry, we're leaving you out here, but what can I say? You need to get a life. All right. There's another problem, cosmic radiation. So we're protected, right, by cosmic radiation. That's why the Earth is special, with these beautiful belts up there that protect us. So as you leave Earth's confines, not only is the dosage increased, but as your speed increases, the dosages of cosmic radiation increase. In fact, they're talking about manned missions to Mars. You know, they're going to be out there for probably 2, 3, 4 years. We don't know yet. And that's highly risky. My personal view on that, we don't even need to do that today. Why do we need to send people? We've got computers and, I mean, the rockets can land themselves, for goodness sake. Why do we need to send people? You know, it just is a marketing thing, really. But here's the single biggest problem with the idea you can fly faster than light speed within our physical universe. You can't. And Einstein predicted that the maximum speed limit in the universe would be the speed of light. In fact, when he says maximum, you would never be able to attain it. So don't think, oh, well, Gary, in the future, you know, they're going to get better with their technology, they're going to develop this. I've shown you some of the other physical problems. But as your speed increases, your mass increases. That's basic physics. As you approach the speed of light, your mass becomes infinite within our physical space-time universe. So realizing that, right? But here's the problem. There are on average about 150 UFO sightings every day. Some of you here, every church I go to, people said they've seen something. You never sure what you saw, for example. But out of that 150, over 90% can always be identified because it's just lay people looking up. We see the International Space Station go ahead. We might see the light of a plane. And why do we interpret these things? You know, we immediately go, oh, look, it's a UFO. But UFO doesn't mean unidentified flying object, does it? When we say UFO, people mean it's a spaceship piloted by aliens, something like that. But, you know, I've been researching this for over 20 years, and it's only in the last couple of years that we've seen a real change. Have you noticed in recent times in the news, the US government, the military, has been admitting that these things exist? And for all the time that I've been doing this, they've always had plausible deniability. I'll go and show you some of the old ones that they denied. So they see these craft defying the laws of physics. And so we realize they can't get here from a galaxy far, far away. The laws of physics don't allow it. So the most popular view today is something called the interdimensional hypothesis. And they're getting somewhere nearer to the truth, but the problem is they don't recognize the nature of it. And it overcomes this travel distance problem. You know, I've seen documentaries and somebody's sitting there claiming they're channeling a message from an alien being and they're saying, oh, we've evolved to a spiritual state. We don't even need craft. We can just will ourselves around the universe or between different dimensions, etc. And we'll talk about this as we go on. Now, the fact is, people do see things. And as a researcher, let me just say to you here, I come from a very conservative Christian background. I'm not a demons under the bed, demon hunter type of guy. So I was very confronted when I started to research some of this, realizing that what we're seeing is really supernatural, interdimensional, if you want to call it that, in nature. Here we go, Mexico, 1997, one of the most well-documented UFO events in history, downtown Mexico City, seen on video cameras, thousands of people saw it. Interestingly, the Mexican government has always been very candid. They've always released the footage. You can look on YouTube, type in Mexican government UFOs. You'll see radar pictures, etc. They've said, we don't know what it is, and they've left it at that. Washington, 1952. These lights buzzed the Capitol Dome of the White House. This is the beginning of the Cold War, ladies and gentlemen. Air Force was dispatched. They chased them, and these lights disappeared to thin air, just vanished. Air Force landed, out came the lights again. We have a general at the time holding a press conference. He says, oh, we can admit, yes, that we saw it, but it's not linked to anything alien or extraterrestrial. But he didn't know what it was. He couldn't tell us what it is, but he said it's definitely not alien. We tracked down one of the radar operators. He's in his 80s now. We interviewed him for the movie that's out there. My book was made into a movie. And he turns around and he says, you know, we were trained to recognize flocks of birds and strange environmental phenomena. He said, this wasn't. These moved at thousands of miles per hour, faster than any fighter jets we have. They merged into one object and then vanished from their radar screens. And he said, you're the first guys that have really ever sought me out who, you know, allowed me to speak openly about it. Roswell, if you're familiar with Roswell, a city in New Mexico. Every year, by the way, they have the annual Roswell Festival. People come from all over the world. They have a map in their museum, and it's got all the pins, and you can see them where people come from all around the world. They have to clear the map every month. July 4 weekend it is. Crop circles, I don't have time to talk about them tonight, fully covered in my book, but people make them. There is nothing supernatural about their appearance, except when they make them, people tell stories of claiming visions and healings, and sometimes people get sick or strange lights appear. My theory on that is, in the same way that people mess around with Ouija boards and tarot cards and they think it's a bit of fun, strange occultic phenomena seems to accompany it. By the way, Roswell, to this day, I think I'm the only Bible-believing creationist ever to have the privilege of speaking at the annual Roswell convention there. It's a town like no other. The town really survives on this alien theme. Last time I was there, there was a 25-foot inflatable green alien standing there outside the Toyota dealership. These are the streetlights. This is my younger daughter, Carla, standing outside of a Coke machine in one of the shops there. The whole town's in on it. Even the McDonald's there is built in this, in the shape of a flying saucer, etc. So it perpetuates the theme. So two things. Science fiction. I like science fiction. I mean, here are just some of the movies. I'll have to update this because obviously Endgame is now the highest grossing movie of all time. And these are some of the TV shows. I mentioned Star Trek. Star Trek The Next Generation, which ran for many years, is the most, still to date, the most syndicated TV show on this planet. Sci-fi is the number one most popular entertainment genre today. And when you see things like Star Trek or Star Wars, and they visit these distant planets and the aliens have different forms and different body shapes, although it's not spoken openly, the unspoken message is, guess what? Evolution took a different turn on their planet. That's why they look different. That's why aliens look different to human beings. So Big Bang and evolution is actually even at the bottom of all our modern science fiction. Evolution and science fiction hand in hand. But as I said, the fact is people do see things, and then there's a deeper aspect to it where people claim that they've had encounters with alien beings. Sometimes they appear in their bedroom, or this is known as abductions, etc. These pictures here, have a look. This is a lady that contacted me, heard me through our ministry that I was writing a book on the subject, and she was so excited that another Christian was getting involved. And she was an artist, and she claimed that some aliens stood at the bottom of her bed, woke her up in the middle of the night, and they told her that Jesus was just an advanced extraterrestrial like them. By virtue of his advanced technology, that's how come he could raise the dead, turn water into wine, etc. And she drew these illustrations, these pictures, they're actually paintings. Elijah, raptured by a flying saucer. Moses spoken to in the burning bush. A radio transmitter beamed down from the mothership and UFOs parted the Red Sea, etc. See, the UFO believers, they actually like the Bible. They think it's a record of ancient contacts, and those primitive people who wrote the Bible wrote them down as gods or encounters with God and angels, etc. So some of you might remember Steven Spielberg, you know, Jaws was his number one big hit, and then follow-up was Close Encounters of the Third Kind. You know, I watched that as a young man, as a non-believer, had a big impact on me. Because it had these utopian themes, these advanced aliens are taking away, you know, the lead character, and they're going to take him off to this planet where, you know, people won't die and they've got all this great technology, etc. Now, some of you, if you've seen the movie, you might remember the lead investigator in the movie was a Frenchman. And he was based, Spielberg based him on a real person. His name was Dr. Jacques Vallée, a Frenchman, one of the world's most foremost UFO researchers, written lots and lots of books. And he had a contemporary, this man there, Dr. Jacques Vallée, and he makes a little cameo at the end of the movie. In part, Spielberg based the movie on some of the research and the writings that they'd had. Now, these are not, you know, out there with the fairies type UFO investigators. These are real scientists. In fact, I'll show you in a minute, Hynek here, he investigated UFOs for the US government under Project Blue Book for over 20 years. And a few years ago, the History Channel did a fictional drama based upon Dr. Hynek. But look what Dr. Vallée wrote. And this was not long after Close Encounters came out. He said, belief in the reality of UFOs is spreading rapidly at all levels in society throughout the world. Books and periodicals appeared at an ever-increasing rate. Documentaries and major films are now made by people of the UFO generation. He says people who grew up just after World War II with these flying saucer stories and have moved into influential positions in the media. Spielberg, he's actually made more movies with science fiction themes than anything else. Paul Allen, one of the co-founders of Microsoft, for years he donated to SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and he was going to have a telescope array named after himself. Hewlett and Packard, they've donated money to SETI, etc. And both he and Hynek, they actually presented their findings on UFOs to the United Nations. And Hynek here, he's deceased now. Now, both of these guys are not Christian, certainly to the best of my knowledge. But I have respect for them because they were candid with the truth, even when it was uncomfortable to the UFO groupies. And look what Dr. Hynek said. He said, certainly the phenomenon has psychic aspects. I don't talk about them very much because to a general audience, the words psychic and occult have bad overtones. They say, oh, it's all crazy. But the fact is there are psychic things, he calls them. UFOs seem to materialize and dematerialize. Here's the thing. There's been a change of outlook, a change of philosophy of persons' lives. What that means is a change in their worldview. He said, those are rather tricky things to talk about openly, but it's there. Many people like Jacques Vallée and I feel to some extent it might be a conditioning process. Right? These were one of the early pioneers that said what happens through UFO encounters changes people's beliefs, basically. Maybe that's why these things happen. So he used words like paranormal, paraphysical. As Christians, what words might we use to describe the same phenomena? Spiritual, supernatural. The Bible actually has a lot to say about that, doesn't it? We don't encounter it very much ourselves, right, being sanctified, but the Bible's pretty clear in its descriptions of the past that people have had encounters with beings from another realm or dimension. Fallen angels, of course, and good angels. But of course, there was one very, very important visitor from that other realm or dimension, if I can put it that way, the Lord Jesus Christ. You know, and he stood there before Pilate, didn't he? He said, my kingdom is not of this world. My kingdom is not from hence or here, for example. And the same Lord Jesus warns us. He gives us a heads up in Matthew 24. He says, there shall arise false Christs, false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. When he says, behold, I have told you before, that's a warning, isn't it? Who's the elect he's talking about there? The church. Be careful. Be careful of signs and wonders. I remember being in a church in New Zealand. I wasn't even talking about UFOs and aliens. And a man came up to me, well-dressed, middle-aged man, and he said, you're wrong about UFOs. And I was like, what? I didn't even say anything about it. But he saw the book on the table. He knew about me. And I said, what do you mean? And I'm pretty used to it by now. When they come up quite assertively, it means they've seen something. So I said, well, tell me about it. He said, oh, it was as big as a football field. It landed. It was glowing white. My wife saw it, didn't you, dear? Et cetera, et cetera. And I said, well, I believe you. You do? Yeah, I believe you saw something. I said, but here's the question. What do you think it was? And he said, well, it was a UFO. And I said, no, no, no. What do you think the UFO was? It was a spaceship piloted by aliens. I said, how did you know that? He said, can't know that. He saw a light, landed. See my point? Why did he say that? It's because of the cultural conditioning we've had. We're hearing this stuff all the time in the media. Etc. And so now with the US government openly admitting that we've seen things and they can't explain what they're seeing, that they defy the laws of physics, I think we're being prepared, ladies and gentlemen. And we don't get into eschatology as a ministry, but I've been doing this subject a long time and we are on a threshold of something very, very different. So the nature of UFOs, well, they've been seen on radar throughout history. Here we go. The ancient Romans, Greeks said they saw flying shields. In fact, in the movie, we have accounts. Alexander the Great said he saw flying shields that buzzed his army. They've been seen on radar by multiple credible witnesses. They materialize and dematerialize. When we say they defy the laws of physics, I can't believe what I'm about to say, but it's there. Yeah, Harry Reid, the former leader of the House under the Obama administration, you can watch him on YouTube. He's admitted that these strange lights, they now call them UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena, have actually entered the ground and affected our nuclear weapons to such an extent that we wouldn't have been able to launch a counter-strike or a first strike if we wanted to. When the government says something like that, that is incredibly serious. So you better believe they're taking notice of these things. And in the movie, we show 2010 Washington Press Club. There's a conference. 80 Air Force officers, not just enlisted guys, Air Force officers, get up and they give their testimony one by one of exactly the same thing that Harry Reid confirmed. And he says they fly at incredible speeds, do right angle turns without slowing down, etc. And the conclusion is, clearly we're dealing with the technology from another realm or dimension, the interdimensional. So what they're appealing to is they're appealing to an unknown to explain, in their view, an unknown. For example, here's one. You might always hear that they used to call it the classic cigar shape, but the reason is we just see them in a two-dimensional image. So they don't make any noise, a lot of these, and they don't kind of speed up like conventional craft. They're there and then, boom, they're gone. Acceleration. Again, if there were any occupants on board, they would not be able to survive. But here's the problem, you know, I can't kind of get a lasso or my tractor beam and bring that thing in to do empirical scientific tests on it. So how do we try to unpick what's going on? I think we can in this disturbing area of what's called alien abductions. This is where people are driving their car at night and they see a light, or they wake up in their room and they see an entity there or some glowing object, etc. And then they have what's called missing time. They wake up hours later and the clock on the dashboard is wound forward, and they have no recollection of what's happened from the time they saw something to the time they wake up. And then what they do, and this is the dangerous part, is they go off to UFO research centers. Here in the United States, the world's largest UFO organization is called MUFON, Mutual UFO Network. And when somebody reports something, they go out and they investigate. And they have hypnotherapists. And then what they do is they hypnotize people, and then they try to collect what they believe are regressed memories during that period of missing time. It's very dangerous because under hypnosis, you can inadvertently supplant memories to people, and when they wake up, they can't distinguish that from, you know, reality, etc. The mind incorporates it. It's a well-known medical phenomenon. So when they do this, then the people recall stories. They don't obviously consciously recollect it, but they say they've been on the spaceship, and they can tell you the colors of the walls. Guess what? They've met Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, all living together in peace and harmony. Okay? There are religious aspects to most of this. Sometimes they have markings on them, injuries and scratches, physical bruises that look like they've been manhandled. And so for researchers like myself, okay, and this is something that was devised by the secular researchers, but it's very useful. It's called the classic abduction syndrome, or the CAS. And what we use this is like a marker, a set of markers. Now, not everybody would have all eight experiences, but you say, well, tell me about it. But they never a genuine experience never falls outside of this grouping. So as I say, there's what we call the capture at night. They're in their room or something. Then they recall being on board the ship and undergoing these crude medical examinations. It's really weird, you know, these highly evolved advanced aliens that can fly spaceship millions of light years come and then poke people with blunt objects. You know, I mean, last time I watched Star Trek, they had their tricorders they could use to, you know, tell you what's wrong with you. They say that they got taken on an otherworldly tour. You know, they visited other star systems, and just in the few hours they disappeared, etc. A theophany. This is meeting a divine being aboard the ship, as I said. You know, stories that Jesus is really just an advanced extraterrestrial, and so on. And again, if you think I'm making light of this, I'm going to show you quotes from leading researchers in the abduction scenario, leading UFO researchers. It's what we call the hostile witness premise, right? They're not going to agree with my Christian hypothesis, but you'll see what I'm telling you is the truth because they're the ones that are saying it. So Donna Higby, she's a hypnotherapist. She's interviewed hundreds of abductees, and she wrote this. She said, I noticed a drastic change in the attitude of several of the abductees from one meeting to the next. People who've been traumatized all their lives by ongoing abductions now, and they originally only had anger and mistrust for the non-human abductors, but they started saying they've been told, shown that everything that happened to them was for their own good. The abductors are highly spiritual beings helping them to evolve spiritually. She said, by accepting this information, the abductees stopped fighting and instead became passive and controlled. That's a medical phenomenon known as Stockholm Syndrome. Have you heard of that? It's where people are kidnapped, you know, by terrorists, locked in a room, and then suddenly they become aligned with the message or the goal of their captors, etc. And she said, when I checked with other researchers, I found this was a pattern repeating itself over and over again around the country. I became concerned that abductees were accepting these explanations from entities, she says, not aliens, that we know can be deceitful. This morning I spoke about deception, didn't I? To be deceived means you're going to be conned into something that is not true. She says we know they are deceitful. Why? Because they tell people stories, things that we can demonstrably show to be false. So I need to be blunt here. If someone tells you a lie, what does that make them? A liar. And the Lord Jesus had some pretty strong words in that area too. When he's talking about Satan, the evil one, he said, he's a liar, the father of lies. There is no truth in him. I take that literally. Because all of these people, they have differing stories. You know, somebody says, well, the aliens abducted me and they told me they're humankind's creators. Where'd they come from? Oh, the Pleiades. Over here, they come from Sirius, Zeta Reticuli, Orion. They can't all be telling the truth, can they? Another researcher, John Keel, deceased now. He wrote lots of books. One of them was made into a movie with Richard Gere called The Mothman Prophecies. Notice this is non-Christian saying this. He said the devil and his demons can, according to the literature, manifest themselves on almost any form, can physically imitate anything from angels to horrifying monsters with glowing eyes. Strange objects and entities materialize and dematerialize in these stories, just as the UFOs and their splendid occupants appear, disappear, walk through walls, and perform other supernatural feats. He recognized it for what it is. He says, demonology is not just another crackpotology. Thousands of books have been written on the subject, many of them authored by educated clergymen, scientists, and scholars. And uncounted numbers of well-documented demonic events are readily available to every researcher. Let me just stop there. He goes on. Readily available to every researcher. I found it. But here's the thing, you see, if you go off to one of those UFO research centers because you think they're the experts that can help you, but they exist to support the idea that aliens are visiting us from a galaxy far, far away. It's like creation evolution. We have abundant evidence that creation is true. But you're only going to get one side of the story in the public education system. That's a half truth, isn't it? Same here. You're not going to get the full story when you read the UFO literature. That's a half truth. Half truth is kind of one other thing too, isn't it? It's a half lie. Because it's only giving you enough information to try to persuade you to their version of the truth. And John Keel goes on and he says, the manifestations and occurrences described in this imposing literature, there's that much of it, are similar, if not entirely identical, to the UFO phenomenon itself. Victims of possession suffer the very same medical and emotional symptoms as the UFO contactees. There it is. A wise man once said there was nothing new under the sun. And remember I said earlier, this is recorded throughout history. People having encounters with the incubus and the succubus, etc. And as I said, the very first deception occurred right back there with the first people. Lucifer, one of the other names we give to Satan, means bearer of light or being of light. Light being synonymous with everything that is good and holy about God. He masquerades as an angel of light. You shall be as gods. It's the same old story, dressed up in a modern guise, evolution and science fiction. And I can tell you, just walk on the street, ask any teenage boy or girl in high school that probably doesn't go to church, do aliens exist? Of course they do. Not maybe, of course they do. And so can you see then what is happening is society is also being prepared. In fact, in the book, I wrote that in the 1980s, the US government surveyed people about the concepts of extraterrestrial life. And they said if it was released back then, it would be paradigm changing. People would panic. I don't think that would be the case today at all. I think if the US government turned around and said, which is probably what I think is going to happen, we're seeing all this stuff. We don't quite know what it is, but it looks to be advanced. So it's probably alien in nature coming from another realm or dimension. People will turn around and go, aha, I knew the government knew about something happening all this time. That's what they'll say. Now, why would the government say something like that? Because they don't recognize the supernatural. They deal in naturalism. And they're dealing with something supernatural. They have to have some naturalistic method of explaining it away. In fact, 1 Timothy 4:1 warns us that the Spirit speaketh expressly that in the latter times some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of devils. There's another heads up. Be careful. Basically, a fallen angel might come and preach a gospel that is different. Jacques Vallée again, he summed it up. I proposed, the first quote I gave you was 1977. This is what he wrote in 2001. I proposed the hypothesis that there is a control system for human consciousness, that what takes place through close encounters with UFOs is control of our human beliefs, control of the relationship between our consciousness and our physical reality. And that this control has been enforced throughout history. It's of secondary importance that it now assumes a form of sightings of space visitors. Yeah, there's a non-Christian just confirming exactly what I told you, ladies and gentlemen. That's what the evidence suggests. In our movie, the modern guru of modern UFO research is this man, Nick Redfern. And we interviewed him, sat in a hotel room in Dallas. I could not believe what this guy said. He's written over 40 books on the subject. He's in Ancient Aliens and Alien Hunters and all those shows on TV. And he sounded like a Christian, you know, and I thought, wow, okay. But he resisted all attempts for us to witness to him. But look what he wrote. He said, there's the nature of the entities themselves. They practically overemphasize who or what they claim to be. We only have to take a careful look at such cases to see that these incidents are clearly stage managed. It's a game, a scenario that has everything to do with trying to emphasize the ET meme. Of course, they could easily avoid us, but here's the deal. They want to be seen. It's not an accident. It's carefully planned, and it's designed to plant an image of ET scientists in the minds of the witnesses. When people have these experiences, their lives are changed. They're often given information, and that information directly contradicts what we read in that very first verse of the Bible. It puts them on a different path. And I mentioned, look at this, Galatians 1:8. Another warning. If we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel unto you than which we have preached unto you, let him be accursed. Fallen angels might come and preach another gospel to us. Is there any precedent for that? Heard of a man called Joseph Smith? Who's he? The father of the Mormon cult. What about a man named Muhammad? Their religions started on the basis of a visitation that they had. It's been going on throughout history, ladies and gentlemen. As I said, this is nothing new under the sun. I have one really exciting bit of information to share with you at the end, but let me deal with this question here. Could God have created life on other planets? I mean, after all, why would God make the universe so big? And a lot of people have come up to me and said, Christians have said, well, Gary, you can't say aliens don't exist because the Bible doesn't mention them. That would be an argument from silence. In fact, if the Bible doesn't mention something, it might be fair to presume that it doesn't exist. But let's look at the big picture of the gospel. and we can deduce, because as I said earlier, the Bible doesn't talk about everything, but we can draw what we call our biblical imperatives from Scripture. Genesis 1:28, it's a favourite creationist passage. We call it our dominion mandate. God told men to go and subdue the earth or fill the earth, right? He put us as the bosses here. That's why when we fell, it spoiled creation. So just imagine if all of these sightings really were aliens in their, you know, faster than light spaceships visiting the earth, and they're created by God, well, actually, they'd have dominion over us, wouldn't they, here? Because by virtue of their advanced technology, they'd be breaking what we call that dominion mandate. But the whole creation groaneth and travaileth. I read that passage out this morning, under sin. So the whole creation is cursed. That's what it tells us. So just think about this. If God had created life on planet, on other planets, you know, poor old Mr. Spock, he's sitting there on the planet Vulcan, and they now get diseases and cancers and they die because of what Adam did here on the earth. Wouldn't sound all that fair, would it? And when God came to this earth, he didn't come as an alien. He came as a human being. Why? To redeem human beings. Remember I said he was called the last Adam. Hebrews 2:16 or 17, it's not angels he helps, but Abraham's descendants, it says. Okay? And all the passages are here, by the way, not just us, but to redeem his creation back to himself. The church, we're Christ's bride throughout eternity. How many brides is he going to have? Is he going to be crucified and raised again on other planets and have all these brides throughout the universe? He'd be a bigamist, wouldn't he? In fact, it's very interesting. This is a symbol of the monogamous relationship that we really, God set in place at the beginning, man and woman. Now, I might be stretching things here, but tell me what you think about this, because when Jesus was on the cross and his side was speared and water and blood poured out, it tells us, as in the book of Isaiah, that the Messiah would shed his blood for the sins of many. That's when we were born into his church, when he died, when he shed his blood, by his blood you and I were bought. And it came out of his side. That's a little bit analogous, isn't it, to what we read in the Garden of Eden? Because where did his bride come from? Where did Eve come from? From his rib, out of Christ's side, for example. So, you've got to be a physical descendant of Adam to be saved. If you're a Klingon or something like that, I'm afraid you don't qualify for salvation. You're not a human. You miss out. Okay? So summing up, so you've got these aliens out there, right, who've been affected by the curse through no fault of their own. They can't be saved because they're not descendants of Adam. But guess what? They're going to get rubbed out at the end of time. God's going to destroy the heavens and the earth. Yes, the universe is cursed. God created the heavens and the earth. That phrase is a grammatical term known as a merism. A merism is when you describe the two opposing ends to include the entirety of the subject matter. Let me give you an example. Hey, tomorrow, let's paint the church from top to bottom. It means we're going to paint everything. That's a merism. The heavens and earth that God created, it says, are being reserved for destruction. The entirety of everything that God made. So these poor aliens sitting out there affected by the curse through no fault of their own. See, I don't think that can be right. Because we're the only ones that God gave a second chance to. Not angels. The angels saw God make. They don't get a chance to believe in Jesus and qualify for salvation. Why would God make intelligent, sentient beings on another planet? And when I say that, that's that level of self-awareness that asks those three big questions. You know, where did we come from? Why am I here? Where am I going? To suffer the opprobrium of the curse and not qualify or have any hope of salvation. In fact, that would make God cruel. And that is something that is not. And 1 Peter 3:18 tells us Christ died for sins once for all. The Bible indicates when our Redeemer returns to the earth, he's still going to carry the scars that he bore for us. The big picture, the Bible's big picture, discounts the idea of sentient, intelligent life. You know the purpose of creation? Was to bring forward a bride for Christ. Not brides, a bride for Christ. And in fact, I think we have to think about it another way, not how big and why, But in this incredibly vast universe, God chose this rocky planet, this speck of dust in the universe, to create life and to have fellowship with us. He talked with Adam and Eve in the garden before the fall. And as I said this morning, when it went all wrong, that creator who made that universe with all those billions and billions of galaxies and stars came here to redeem us back to himself. That's so much love, I can't even quantify it. You know, when we look out, yes, the universe is a big place. I don't know, I've been able to do it in the Australian outback, get away from light pollution. Have you ever done that? You look up in the night sky. The sky is full of stars. It takes your breath away. But you know, if you could count the number of stars with your naked eye, you'd only count about 9,000 points of light. And yet God says to Abraham right at the beginning, I'll make your descendants like the grains of sand on the seashore, right? Like the stars at night, like the grains of sand. You could actually go home tonight, type into Google, how many stars are there in the universe? And about the first, I don't know, last time I did it, 9 or 10 pages all come up with a little summary. The stars in the universe have been equated with grains of sand on Earth. Where'd they get that from? You know, what happens is because of the subject matter and the things we're exposed to in the culture today, even as Christians, we kind of look up and we go, wow, wonder what else is out there. We should look up and go, my God, what is man you are mindful of him? I can't even fathom that. You know, there's a reason the universe is the way it is. The Bible tells us the answer. About 13 times we have passages like this. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. When you look out there, be thinking about the God who made it all. Okay? Not what else might be out there. And here's the thing. Only the Creator has the power to save us. Now, I'm not demeaning or diminishing the things that people see or the experiences they've had. I'm one of very few people on this planet that's met hundreds of them as part of my research and the book. They send me emails. After the movie, I got inundated with hundreds of emails from experiences, just sharing their stories on a special website that we created. You can look at them, alienintrusion.com. But these people that claim to have been on board the spaceship, nobody, you know, managed to steal a book of matches from the living room or bring back a towel from the bathroom. There's no physical evidence that's ever come back. And that's because what's happening to them is illusory and it's emanating from the spiritual realm. That's why. And that's the only thing that makes sense. So I'll share with you in a moment. I want to share with you a story. But as I said, don't forget all the information on our website. If I could say this, and I'm not trying to sound like a salesman, but I've been in ministry a long time. If you want one resource to get, it's the magazine. Because it comes out quarterly, it's sent to you, it's up to date, it's easily read, and it's easy to share. You don't have to say anything. Put it on the lunch table at work. Let it do its work. And that's the testimonies that we've had. You know, my first trip back to Australia was in 2012. And I was at a church and this young man came up to me and all he kept saying was, thank you, Mr. Bates, thank you. And he started to break down and cry, which is why I remember it. And I said, look, send me an email and give me your testimony. And this is now in our testimony database. And this is what he wrote. Thank you for your ministry. As a child, a family friend bought me a subscription to Creation Magazine. I attended public schools where evolutionists taught, but the information provided to me through your magazine, my faith was never shaken by evolution. He said, I'm now a Sunday school teacher and my favorite topic is showing God's glory through creation. I attribute your magazine as a major contributor to the strength of my faith and my love of science. Thank you again. So I talked this morning about the exodus of youth. Look what happened here. Somebody sent a magazine to his mailbox and he was not only preserved in the faith, but his faith flourished. He was able to withstand all the teaching that he got. So we have some forms on the table out there, okay, that you can get. There they are. 1 year, $29. You get the free, you get the digital version for free. If you sign up for 2 years, okay, you get the digital version, but we give you two DVDs that are on there. Those two DVDs, if you go to our website, they're $19 each. That's $38 worth of free DVDs for a $50 subscription, plus the digital that's also worth $19 as well. All right. The most popular article probably in all my years of ministry in the magazine was this one, the two-tone twins. And there they are. Okay, how many skin colors do you think there are? There's one. We all humans have the same skin color. It's a brownish pigment called melanin. Some people have a lot of it, some people don't have much at all. See, I'm supposed to be white. Well, there's a white piece of paper. Have a look. Am I white? No, I'm light brown. Some people are mid-brown. In fact, 70% of the world's population today has medium brown skin, medium brown hair, medium brown eyes. It's a pigment that our DNA codes for. It's called melanin. Now, when you have lots of melanin, it's a natural sunscreen in hot environments. In my home country of Australia, we have the highest rates of skin cancers in the world. But, you know, when they rediscovered Australia in 1788, they found very dark-skinned Aboriginal people living there. Why? Well, think about that. After the flood, remember I showed you with the dogs? In one generation, Adam and Eve had many sons and daughters. They would have fair-skinned children and dark-skinned children because Adam and Eve possessed all the information necessary to produce variation of skin shade in their offspring. Melanin codes for your hair and your eyes, by the way. And so when we featured this in the magazine, have a look. Two-tone twins, there's the parents. Medium brown skin, medium brown hair, medium brown eyes. There's the girls growing up today. So Adam and Eve, we always thought, and now modern genetics confirms our suspicions that Adam and Eve would have been in the medium brown skin range, skin shade, etc., to be able to produce that variation that we see around the world today, etc. You know, my wife, somebody came up to me earlier and said, you call a nickname for Australian women Sheilas down under. Yes, we do. It's not derogatory. But my wife, I'd call her a typical blonde Aussie Sheila. She's got blonde hair, blue eyes, fair skin. Right? My children, four adult children, all fell out on her side of the gene pool. Blonde hair, blue eyes, fair skin. I didn't even get a look in. So when you have blonde hair, very little melanin. Fair skin, very little melanin. Blue eyes, they're not actually coloured blue. Virtually no melanin. The light refracts back out and gives the impression that they're blue in colour. It's a lack of melanin. So just imagine, you know, if you are a natural blonde, right, blonde hair, blue eyes, fair skin, and you married somebody else that had blonde hair, blue eyes, fair skin, and they married somebody else had blonde hair, blue eyes, fair skin, just like those dogs, you'd only ever produce blonde hair, blue eyes, fair skin people, which I pointed out to my wife one day during an argument that it shows that blondes really do have less information. genetic information, I meant by that, of course. So again, the answers book, every Christian home should have a copy of this. Let me boldly say that, because all the questions we get when we run question and answers and the questions, thousands of questions that get sent to the ministry every year are usually covered in the answers book. People have the same questions. I mentioned this one, the book, Evolution's Achilles Heels, and the DVD. Remember I said evolution makes predictions. Well, natural selection is one of those. If natural selection is true, we should see mutations giving increase in information in the genome. We don't see it. Geology, this morning, the millions of years. It's an absolute, if you deal with the millions of years, you avoid the confusion of trying to add them to the Bible, but there is no evolution. There's no time for evolution. You've got to deal with the millions of years. Dinosaurs, one of the most asked subjects, and I'll flick through some of those. This key book, you can read it like a book. It's not a very difficult read, but it is absolutely comprehensive. You want one book on creation, all right? That's the one to get. And as I said before, one book on dinosaurs. This is brand new. It's only been out a month. This is only the second ministry event I've been. Soft tissue, carbon dating of dinosaur fossils, etc. And this, I think, would be great for home study or even here in the church. This is a 12-part DVD series, very professionally produced, great graphics, everything else. No lesson is more than 40 minutes in length. So they're designed for Bible studies, home groups, maybe Sunday school teaching in the church. And there's free study guide. Look on the back of the box. You get the free study guide online. You can print out as many copies as you like. Genesis 1 through 11 in 12 parts there. This morning I gave a talk called Why Does a Good God Allow Bad Things? There's a DVD there, and it's an expanded version of the talk I gave this morning. And I dealt with the issue just briefly on who made God. I actually have a whole talk on that. Okay, and I said this is one that teenagers ask me all the time, so I go a bit more in depth. And if God is the creator, right, we say he made in 6 days. I said earlier this morning, it looks like he didn't even take, nor was not going to take 6 days for the new heavens and the new earth. I often say to evolutionists, Christians who believe in evolution, so you believe that God created over millions of years through a process of death and suffering. Are you looking forward to that in the new heavens and earth? Because it doesn't make sense. It's a restoration, isn't it? And so finally, here's the book that I mentioned there, and there is the movie. And my board is the one that compelled me to make the movie. I was not all that keen. Movies consume 3 years of your life at least, but we're glad we did. We have received, as I've said, thousands of testimonies from around the world about this. If you've got friends, young ones, want an introduction, don't want to talk to you about creation evolution, hey, you want to watch a movie about aliens? And for those of you that have seen it, you know this movie is all about Jesus. In fact, let me tell you a story. With Evolution's Achilles Heels, we sent it off to the San Antonio Christian Worldview Festival. And we just said, we'll just send it off. It was like $30 to join. And we got second place. We thought, wow, okay, that's interesting. So when we made this, we sent it off to various film festivals, including the world's largest film festival. It's called the Remy Film Festival, held in California in 2018. This is a secular Hollywood film festival where Spielberg and Francis Ford Coppola have cut their teeth and whatever. And we just sent it off and said, you know what, at least a few people get to watch a Christian movie in a very, very secular environment. What I'm about to tell you is the honest truth. A package arrived in the office one day and I opened it up and it was from the Remy Film Conference, and Alien Intrusion won a bronze award, which means that it was ranked in the top 10% of all movies aired that year. You know how many movies were aired that year? 5,500. A Christian movie in the center of Hollywood, that got a bronze award. And it was all about Jesus. Praise God, isn't he incredible that he allows these things to happen? And there's a lecture there, a bit similar to tonight, plus the book and some witnessing tracks, etc. Last thing, a bit of information. In the book, I tell the story, in fact, of this man. He's in the middle there. That's me at the top. That's Dr. Hynek. This man here, his name is Joe Jordan. He's a field research investigator for MUFON. He wasn't a Christian. He and his colleague, when people have sightings, they would go out, interview them when they had abductions, etc. And the strangeness of the phenomena, the non-physical aspects, confuses a lot of researchers. So they said, let's think outside the box. Instead of looking at who has been, you know, abducted, we don't believe they're being abducted, of course, we call them experiences now. He said, is there any significant group of people that haven't? So they looked back through their research, and then they came across some cases where people in their moment of terror, okay, in their alleged abduction experience, would call out on the name of Jesus Christ for help in fear, resorting to, you know, their childhood faith or something like that. And they read them and they went, this is interesting. The aliens disappeared when the name of Jesus was mentioned. So these are non-Christians discovering this, right? So they rang their colleagues in MUFON. And to their surprise, all their colleagues knew about it. So, well, so what? Aliens don't like Christians, big deal. And that's how they dismissed it. So they got written up in the Florida Today newspaper. Okay, telling these stories of what they'd found. And they had literally hundreds of people contact them over the next few months. The story went from Florida Today and it went viral, went around the world. And now they have, he said, well, what is it about this phenomenon that we don't understand? So they took themselves off to church to find out what it was about Christians that made them distinctly distasteful to these alleged aliens. And guess what happened to them? They got saved. And now, the last time I saw him, and he's in the movie, they've got over 400 cases where people having these alleged abduction experiences have sang hymns, called on the name of Jesus, and it's halted in its tracks. And you will hear the testimonies of some of those people in the documentary out there. What does that tell you about the spiritual nature of this phenomenon, ladies and gentlemen? There it is. And you will see some of the leading movers and shakers themselves, secular people who say what we are dealing with is spiritual. And one guy even uses the word demonic, and he's not even a Christian. So you don't have to believe me. This is what the secular people are saying. But of course,